There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Castaway, what's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
This week we are stranding Adrian Hayes, so congratulations on the text line to, Gavin, Karina, they all named him correctly. Adrian Hayes, a British polar explorer and adventurer and author of Footsteps of Thesiger and upcoming book K2, The Tragedy and the Triumph, which he'll be sharing with us all at the 2018 Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
Welcome to the show, Adrian. So you've got three books with you. And just out of curiosity, how much survival instinct for this sort of scenario? I mean, Jonathan and I were saying that of all the guests we've had on, you're probably the one who'd survived long enough to actually read their books.
Yeah, good morning. Can I burn them to use fire?
You've read them.
After you've read them, of course. Yeah. Well, that's very complimentary. But yeah, it's a fascinating thing because I've always thought, you know, if it's Desert Island Disc, a similar concept, what music would I have on there? So it was an interesting question when you approached me a few weeks ago about this.
Yeah. Amongst breaking world records in your capacity as desert and polar explorer and adventurer and writing books about your experiences, you're also a business coach, which I think is something that you share with the author of the first book you're bringing to your desert island.
Yeah, I do my coaching work, leadership development, team development, and personal development. That's in the in my whole work. It's been a passion. It's my studies, my life, everything for the past 20 odd years or so. So, yeah, my first book. Let me just be honest right from the start. I don't read fiction. And, you know, I know there's people out there gasping, how can you possibly get this girl? But
Flora's fainting over there.
Flora, she's fainting. Apologies for that.
So you raised eyebrows in the studio.
So it's been nice talking to you. But no, the point is, I get why do people read? I mean, a lot of people read for relaxation, for various other things. I read for learning. And when I am so busy with not just training, but training and my work and my business and all this sort of stuff, there isn't much time. And so if I'm going to spend the time to read a book, it's to learn. And amongst that learning, the world of personal development. I started reading the books about 20 odd years ago, the first ones. And the first book, you know, it was one of the first books I read was Awaken the Giant Within from Tony Robbins. Now, Robbins is an interesting character. He is probably one of the leading guys in this whole world. And I mean, look, for those listening on the show today, the world, you know, this whole spectrum of personal development, of self-help and all the rest of it. You've got right from one end the spiritual enlightenment stuff, the healing, and you're moving up the line, the therapy, counseling, coaching, NLPs in there, mentoring, and then consultancy. You've got this whole, and further on the business line. Now, what Robbins did in the early days was people in America and the States, you know, everyone in America has their therapist, you know, everyone has their therapist, and people were coming to him when he got this thing, and there was nothing actually wrong with them, but they wanted help with their lives. And so he was one of the sort of forerunners of the coaching movement, and he wrote the first book, I think, Unlimited Potential was his first book, and then his second book was Awaken the Giant Within. It's early 90s, and I read it I got into this whole world about 93, 94 when I was a young boy, of course. But around 97, I read the book. So it's pretty powerful.
Why is he so popular? I mean, his popularity, I actually hadn't heard of him until about 6 months ago. And I had dinner with somebody who had been to one of his seminars in the Excel Center in London, and I thought, that's a strange place for a seminar. And she said, no, because there has to be space for tens and tens of thousands of people. And yeah, over the course of his coaching career, he has coached 2 or 3 million people. And that is an extraordinary figure, I would say unparalleled by a factor of 10 to his next competitor. What has he got that others don't?
Well, he's got an energy about him, which is quite remarkable. The guy spoke on the first... I did that, the Unleash the Power Within. It's the UPW, the London seminar. Mm. And, you know, look, a lot of my sort of coaching, or some of my coaching colleagues would say his world is popular psychology. He's popularized the world of personal development. But the guy spoke on the first day for about 10 hours nonstop.
I've heard that. And I no matter how many times I hear that from people who have attended his seminars, I still struggle to believe it. Do you mean he was on stage speaking non-stop, delivering his seminar for 10 hours?
Yes.
Are you serious?
It went on, I think it came on about 1 p.m. and it ended about midnight, something like that.
Did he
now eat? That included a firework, which is a, I think a firewalk, which is a bit of a hype. I don't agree with that sort of thing. But yeah, did he?
Is that the one where they walk over hot coals?
Yeah, that was a little bit of gimmick, to be honest. It was a few little splat little hot coals. I didn't think much of that thing. And the bad bit about the so if you imagine a rock concert, because the music was on every sort of a mixture of a rock concert, a highly motivational guy Tony Robbins, and like an evangelical gathering. That was like the thing. And some bits I don't like, to be honest. I mean, when he came off the stage, people rushing forward to touch the great guru. And I don't get that. You know, he's only a guy at the end of the day. I respect him for what he's done. His writing is great. But some of the hyping and the sales pitching was a little bit too much. But it was, he was on stage, yeah, for 10 hours. So 9 hours, something like that. And I don't know how he went to the bathroom. That's a mystery I'm still working out as well.
I was wondering.
But it was an experience. I think it's one for people to go to.
Well, why don't you tell us about... okay, so moving away from Tony Robbins, tell us about the Adrian Hayes pre-Awaken and the Adrian Hayes post-Awaken. What did you get out of this book or this seminar? What's Tony Robbins given you?
I think with and I won't just put Robbins. It was a difficult choice to put one book on the whole world of personal development. I've learned, you know, Deepak Chopra, I've read Robin Sharma's stuff, Margaret Wheatley. There's Peter Drucker. There's a lot of these people, and people were around long before, or some of them were long before Tony Robbins. To me, what he gave me was, you know, in his tapes again, it's just giving that little bit of realism behind the sort of the whole. You can get, look, it's similar when I do my own coaching work. It's people want practical things, and that you can go into this university professor type theories and, you know, analysis. And I use all my own work. I use bits of science about, you know, of energy work and all this sort of stuff throughout. But it's getting it into a practical thing that I could relate to more than most people. I just like his energy. I'm an energetic person myself. Not always, because I'm so shattered, but usually. But it's something that sort of related to me. So I relate to the guy more than sort of most.
When I looked up Tony Robbins and this book and his career path, I found myself wondering, yes, why the popularity, but also why he decided to do this in the first place, and what was that moment that spurred him to become the Tony Robbins that we know today? And I think if we're talking about Tony Robbins and him being a great speaker, we need to hear him speak. So have a listen to this.
When I was 11 years old, I had no money and no food in our family. My father lost his job, and my mom and dad were saying things to one another that you know, once you say them, you can never take them back. And I'm the oldest of three, and I can remember vividly, not worried that I was going to starve. You know, we always found a way to survive, but just worried that our family would stay together. It didn't, unfortunately, long term, but that's what I'd hoped for at that time. And there was a knock on the door, and a man came to the door. I opened the door because my dad wouldn't answer. He was busy yelling at my mom. And I opened the door, this big, tall guy with this huge box filled with food, and there was a pan on the ground with an uncooked turkey in it. And he said, "Could I speak to your father?" And my father was not real great on taking charity. I won't waste the time telling you the whole details, but he wouldn't accept it. But the man just basically embarrassed him into it. He said, "Don't let your family, you know, suffer because of your ego. This is from somebody who knows you're having a tough time, and they want you to just be able to thrive, to have a great Thanksgiving." And so my dad took the food and slammed the door, and it changed my life. It changed my life because up until that time, my father has always told me that nobody gives a damn about anybody else. And there's so much evidence in the world, even at Christmas time and, you know, any holiday season, there's so much to look at in the world where people are heartless. It's easy to then think that's how all people are. And that day, the greatest gift of that was not the food we had. The greatest gift is it stuck in my head that strangers really do care. And if strangers cared about me and my family, then I decided I would share about, I'd find a way to care for strangers too.
Adrian Hayes, do you identify with that? Did you have that sort of eureka moment that set you off on that kind of Tony Robbins path?
Yeah, and I think... you know, out of every crisis comes opportunity, or your greatest learnings comes from your greatest periods of despair. He had a tough childhood, a tough young upbringing. And, you know, I was a great deflector of things. But when you get in touch with some of this stuff that we all carry around, it was, you know, I had a bit of, it wasn't, it wasn't as bad as that, but certainly, you know, my early adventures and my, I had Polar Explorers on my wall, pictures of Polar Explorers, and I wrote to Ranulph Fiennes, we're going to speak about him a bit, as a young, as a young teenager or whatever it was, and Chris Bonington, you know, because mine was Escape. I wanted to escape from a, you know, rather unhappy child. So I think, yeah, all this stuff, we all carry this baggage around with us, and it's the secret is to get really get in touch with it and then and propel it, make it a force for good rather than bad.
So there you have it. That's Adrian Hayes with his first Desert Island book, but he can't escape us just yet, even though physically he probably actually could escape the Desert Island very easily. So text in to 4001 if you've got any questions or comments. Remember, you can do that any time or use the Dubai iMessenger app. Coming up, another man who likes to live dangerously. Adrian kind of gave it away just there. So dangerously that he was considered to play James Bond despite zero acting experience. Stay tuned if you think you know who I'm talking about.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So what's the second book that you've got for us today, Adrian?
So having got the self-development one, that's one of them, I thought, well, let's get an adventure book. And who better to go for than Ranulph Fiennes, now with the book Living Dangerously. And I first met Ran when he was down in Salalah, because I served in Salalah with the Omani Armed Forces for a couple of years, and he was down there on his expedition to find the lost city of Ubar, the Atlantis of Sand. And I met him there the first time. And we've kept in touch over the years. And when I read this book years later, it was this sort of first autobiography. I was reading about Ran. And
I love that you call him Ran.
Yeah, he calls it... He's...
What does he call you?
Yeah, Adrian. Are you AIDS?
Yeah. he doesn't... Look, the Sir Ranulph... Oh my God, I've got a thing about... knighthoods anyway.
He doesn't insist on being called sir.
He's done the foreword for both my books, that's Footsteps of Thesha and the K2 book, and he even took off the sir, you know, he doesn't want, you know, so the official publication fooled by Sir Ranulph Fiennes, but he is Ran, okay, and he's Ran to his friends, and it's a good way to be.
How would you describe him for people who haven't heard of
Ranulph Fiennes? Sir Ranulph, he is, yeah, good question. He is, the Guinness Book of Records calls him the world's greatest living explorer. Certainly, you know, maybe debatable site, because there's a lot of great Norwegians and others out there, but certainly amongst the Brits he's done more than anyone. I mean, he's pole to pole, crossed both ice caps, he's still going at age 75 years of age, something like that. He's climbing a few mountains around the world, but he's an ex-army officer, and the point I was going to come to when I read his book Living Dangerously, I was reading this whole thing about ex-army officer, served in Oman, served with the SAS, and get into the polar world, and I was like, this is actually looking rather like my own life history, you know. And it was because I did all these things as well, and so I got a great resonance with him. And served, you know, then the whole desert expedition was when the whole they got to know each other a lot even more. So he's a great guy. If anyone has not, he comes out here quite regularly to speak. He has the driest sense of humor you've ever heard of anyone. When he speaks, he doesn't break into big energy and this, I did this and Tony Robbins way like this.
Right.
He's just this deadpan, monotonous thing, but it's hilarious.
Mm.
And he tells these amazing, funny jokes, like a one-liner every few seconds. It's just hilarious.
And the book, Living Dangerously, that's his story.
Yeah, and why I chose that one. And he's quite prolific on the books. I mean, he's basically... he does an expedition of something and then writes a book about it, doesn't he? And that's the way he gets his living. Living Dangerously was his sort of first autobiography. He's also updated since then, but it was the one that really resonated with me. He talked about his army days, his SAS days, his desert days, and that's why I think it's a favourite book of mine. It's the one I've got at home. It's all battered and it's been up this mountain and up everywhere, but I take with a desert island as well, because it's a little bit of a affection with it.
And so Ranulph Fiennes, this is someone who, as an explorer, is not always successful. So, for example, his expedition to the North Pole without dogs, on foot, he was unsuccessful. He was unsuccessful on one of his journeys across Antarctica during the polar winter. What do you take from that?
I think you'd have to ask him that one, to be honest. There's no room for error on any of these polar expeditions, and I've done three major ones, walking to the North Pole, the South Pole, and the length of Greenland, and you have to get everything in place. But also there's luck as well, and sometimes you're unlucky, and particularly the North Pole, it's now just become the most brutal thing. It's the hardest thing in the world, and that's why nobody manages to do it these days.
North Pole?
The North Pole, yeah. So it is. Nobody's managing to do it at all.
Well, you were talking earlier about his dry sense of humour and the fact that he's completely the opposite of Tony Robbins, so he doesn't make a big song and dance about all the amazing things that he's done. And one of the things that he's done shocked me a little bit, and I'm not going to spoil it for you. I'm just going to let you listen to Ranulph Fiennes tell you an amazing story.
You have put yourself through absolute hell, and here in your left hand, you don't have any of the finished fingers of your left hand anymore. And that was, you had to actually medicate yourself for that, didn't you? You had to do some chopping yourself for your fingers.
Yeah, but that was back in the UK, and that was only because my late wife said I was getting very irritable, because touching the mummified fingertips against anything, it really was painful, and they don't operate and amputate properly until 5 months after the thing happens. So in order to stop the pain, I bought a Black & Decker and a micro blade. And my late wife brought me cups of tea, and it took 2 days to get through the thumb by sort of turning it round. And if it hurt or bled, then you move the saw further away.
Ranulph Fiennes there on Newsnight talking about amputating his own hand with a Black & Decker because he's laughing. Sir Ranulph Fiennes, and he's nuts, but we love him.
So just to sort of put a bit of meat on the bone of that story,
oh, nice one,
is
nice
that
one.
This was following his solo and unsupported North Pole expedition, during which his sledge slipped through weak ice and he had to pull it out by hands. His hands got wet, he sustained frostbite in the tips of his fingers, and when he returned home, his doctor advised him that the tips of his fingers were necrotic, but they would have to be left for some months to allow the regrowth of the healthy tissue. He became impatient with that and so decided to take matters into his own hands.
This is something that you must have to worry about quite a bit.
Yeah, as you see, my your listeners can't see what I'm doing here with my finger. Yeah, doing a little child game. Look, you do, but you don't get frostbite, you know. And it's one little thing I'd say you can't afford to get blisters, let alone frostbite. And you just can't. You got to, and you know, my hands have got so cold over some of these things. I had to whirl my hand sometimes for 10 minutes like this. I'm basically whirling my hand in a big wheelie right now. 10 minutes to get some life back into the whole thing. You just can't afford to get it, because if you do, it just scuppers the whole expedition. So you know, it's always a concern, but you got to look after yourself before anything else, and that's it's the old oxygen mask scenario. When the oxygen comes down, you know, look after yourself and then others after you.
So what's the most that you've actually got from the Living Dangerously book? So
you know, it puts into perspective a breaking the boundaries. I think he was quite rebellious. I think, yeah. I was as well. Again, it was just reading this reading my own sort of autobiography in a way, which I haven't done yet, but maybe when I'm 95 I'll get around to it. But it's breaking the boundaries, you know, challenging yourself, you know, always pushing things. And also, it put into perspective the huge workload. I mean, he put 5 years on into getting his Transglobe expedition off the ground, and his late wife was a key supporter of that. So there's a lot of learning of the support, you know, the support of your partner, the workload, the whole intricate detail, the pushing the boundaries. And he does it. He'll say it himself. He does it to be the first. And I don't. That's not my reason for doing the stuff I do now. But he was always looking for that record of something that hadn't been done before.
This may sound like a silly question, but are there many things left to be the first to do?
That's a very good question, and the answer is no. And this is why you're getting in this whole adventure world. You're getting firstly, combination records, you know, seven summits, fastest time. You're getting youngest people, which I think is totally, utter rubbish, you know, youngest to ever do this. You're getting oldest people die. You're getting gimmicks. It's because you need the sponsorship. Sponsors need publicity. And, you know, to get publicity, you need to do something that hasn't been done, or some great, you know, gimmick, the highest dinner party in the world, or things like that. So I don't like where it's all going, to be honest.
Where do you draw the line? I mean, I like to do a bit of running. And I would certainly draw the line at doing anything like the Marathon de Sable or rowing across an ocean, for example. I get the sense that you would be game for that. But is there a line?
I'll tell you where you draw the line. There's a guy called Alex Honnold, a free climber. Now, he free climbs without any ropes, without any belaying, doesn't even have a parachute on his back, and he climbs these great walls, Yosemite National Park, with nothing. Now,
I think this might be the guy that just did El Capitan in a...
That's him. Right, yeah, that's him. The guy is absolute nuts. But, you know, respect for his ability to do this and his pushing the boundaries of fear. But we've all got our own comfort zones. You know, I do things, I've taken novice groups on treks and I've just scampered up a rock face, which is, you know, like this, and I'm just putting in a 45 degree angle. People wouldn't go up that. I wouldn't do that. So, you know, there's a difference between measured risk and reckless risk. And he takes it because it's only one slip, one loose rock that could all go scuppers.
So there you go. That's Adrian Hayes with his second desert island book, Living Dangerously Even, by Sir Ranulph Fiennes.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
Well, Adrian, so 5 miles swim, and from that to the studio, and we are going to be talking about your final book of the session. You said you don't read literature. We're not going to let you get away with that, because you have suggested something, which is, I would say, or fiction, I should say, which is fiction. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is, well, the first book was The Self-Development, that's The Mind. The second one was Ranulph Fiennes, which was The Body, and mm-hmm. Living Dangerously. This is The Spirit, and if you... People aren't worried that mind, body, spirit, it's all part of my work and everything like that. And I've got a fictional tale, The Celestine Prophecies by James Redfield, which is a fictional book. But I could have had things like The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari, Robin Sharma. They're all fictional parables, but they're basically more spiritual than pure fiction.
Okay, so this is a book that was published in 1993, spent 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list. Tell us what it's about.
Well, again, there's a parable tale, but you've got to look. It's a long time since I read it, by the way, so I just have to remember.
Okay.
but a parable tale of a story, but it's beneath the tale about how we all are in this world that we live in and improving our awareness, our consciousness, and our mindfulness. And that's what basically the book is about, operating on a slightly different frequency and different level than we are in this cluttered overload information world we live in. And why I relate to this is because some people get this from the sort of meditation world, some people get it from six of my friends went on a vision quest retreat down in the Empty Quarter a few days ago. I get it on my expeditions. And when you come back after 2 months or 3 months, somewhere particularly like Antarctica, and come back to the so-called real world, I'm in a completely different place. I'm operating on this completely different frequency, and it's hard to relate. And I've said it in the book, and I've said it in some of my speeches, that I'm sometimes wonder whether this is the real world here or that is the real world. If it's sitting around a campfire talking in the middle of nature, I sometimes think that the latter is more the real world than the one we live in.
You've mentioned The Alchemist, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari, and other kind of fictional parables. But in The Alchemist, I mean, what's the fictional hook here that tries to get that message across?
Well, The Alchemist was about the young boy, you know, did his old journey. I mean, it comes down to consciousness. It comes down to consciousness and sort of the again, what I've just repeated, that's what it comes to me. You know, people may see sort of different things from reading the book, but it's that sort of different frequency, a different level of operating your mind.
Okay. And I know that we've mentioned the Alchemist a couple of times here, because it's hard not to talk about this without mentioning The Alchemist, because it's, you know, one of the topmost fictional parable books out there. The secret of life, though, is to fall 7 times and to get up 8 times. And this made me think of you and your K2 journey, Adrian. And I kind of want to talk about that a little bit, because you've achieved a lot. You've broken records, but you don't get there without falling down a few times. Could you tell us a little bit about what it was about K2 that stumped you and your new book?
Yeah, well, K2, for those listening who don't know, the world's second highest mountain, located on the Pakistan-Chinese border. It's about 200 meters lower than Everest, which I climbed in 2006. But the numbers speak for itself. Everest has been climbed by about 4,800 people now, K2 by 350-odd. And the reason is the weather's always atrocious. It's a steep, a technical rock climb, ice climb. It's got avalanche dangers, rockfall dangers. It's a dangerous, dangerous mountain.
So that it is because it's a harder technical challenge, not just because people are less keen to climb the second highest mountain.
There's many people would want to climb it, but it's obviously the biggest will always get the numbers. But it's a difficult climb. You've got to be an experienced climber. And so there's not many years as many very few people sort of attempt it. The last I'll tell the story what happened, you know, because Annabelle, you asked me, 2013 went into it, and only 20 of us climbing, different teams, 7 teams, and basically all of us pushing for the summit. Things were happening around us. The weather was terrible. Snow conditions terrible. And 18 of us came down. Two guys went up, a father and son, and they were killed that night in an avalanche at Camp 3. And that father and son, highly experienced. And we're not talking just a, highly experienced mountain guide. He was well known across the whole adventure world. And so, you know, the stats are terrible. For every four that summit K2, one dies trying. It's a hugely risky enterprise. And so people thought I was crazy to even try the first time. But I went back the second time, the year later, because something again, you know, and this comes out in my book, why I went back. And we summited, managed to summit in 26th of July 2014.
The thing I wonder about you, and a lot of people like you attempt these things, you said two went up and they didn't come back. But you decided to go back. And I was reading this quote from Sir Anil Fiennes you were talking about earlier. He said, there'll be a voice in my head saying I'll have a heart attack, I'll get hypothermia, I've got a family, it's stupid to carry on. That sort of wimpish voice tries to appear logical, finding reasons for stopping. You have to fight it. I've had it so many times. Do you have it every time you go up?
Yeah. And you've got to... I said it before, one of the things about measured risk versus reckless risk. Yeah. Now, Ed Vistas, a famous American mountaineer, said, you know, getting to the top is optional, getting back down again is mandatory. So you've got to be very circumspect. You've got to be also very clear, I get, about why you're doing this thing. Why is actually, you know, what is your clear objectives? And so I was very clear why I wanted to do this thing. But
why did you want to do it?
I do these things for the learning. That's the main thing. It used to be for the world records and everything like that, but the achievement. K2 was a gold medal in mountaineering, but I suppose I do it for the learning now. And there's other deeper reasons within this book. And, you know, and turn the book, and basically how this book came about, I had no intention of writing a book on it, but I'd spoken the story around a few places in Dubai, London, in Hong Kong and Houston. It was the daughter of Marty Smith who died, who begged me to write the book. And so she wrote me the book, but I thought what I didn't want to do was just bring another mount adventure book. You know, we climbed up here, we climbed down here, we had avalanches here, avalanches there. And I really wanted to bring in the whole mental aspect, how you confront risk, how you confront what is the driver, what was the whole thing going on. So it's bringing in basically what I've spoken on this show so far about mind, body, spirit. You've got the body side of the expedition, you've got the story itself, and then the mental side, the bodily side, the physical training, and the sort of enlightenment side as well. Because, you know, and it's about, you know, get serious, when you're faced with death, you learn some things about yourself. And we were very lucky in 2013, very lucky in 2014. But so I'm really proud of the book, and it's that it took a long time to write, to get the whole right concept. But I hope it's got something for everyone, not just hardcore adventurers, but anyone interested in personal development, in physical, you know, alchemist type fans or whatever.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Talking of Books on 103.8, and we're talking to Adrian Hayes about the three books that he took with him to a desert island. And his newest book, or his upcoming book, I should say, K2, The Triumph and the Tragedy. When exactly is it going to be out, Adrian, so we can have a read of it?
We are launching on 10th of March, Saturday 10th of March. It's the last day of the Emirates Literary Festival, so it's going to be launched that day at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. My good friends Motivate Publishing, who published my first book, Footsteps of Thestia, and I got to say, great support of Jay Resorts, Jebel Ali. Some people know Jay Resorts and hotels who've come and sponsored the book.
And tickets for that, by the way, will go on sale beginning of January, and you can get them from EmiratesLitFest.com. There are some already available for sale there, but Adrian's will be on sale beginning of January. And yeah, so any parting thoughts? I mean, one thing I wanted to cover with you, Adrian, so we've talked about the physical preparation that goes into expeditions, and I'm glad that you've kind of talked about the mental preparation that goes into it as well. Is that something that you've trained over the years, or is it something that you think that explorers have to partly be born with as well?
Yeah, I suppose a bit of both, to be honest. I mean, I started doing all this adventure stuff as a young boy, crossing my marshlands in the forest when I was 6 or 7, and then much more when I started climbing age 16, and then obviously being in the army, British Army, for 10 years in total. That gives you that little bit of a dogmatic mind and a sense of humour at the worst sort of possible times. So yeah, it's a bit of both, I'd say, Annabelle.
Can we go back to risk briefly? You are a dad.
Indeed, I am.
How would you feel about your children taking some of the risks that you take?
It's a great question. I would always take my kids on a mountain climb. I think rock climbing is fantastic because it's a great bonding experience. It's amazing. Would I take my son or daughter up K2? No.
Mm.
Far too risky. It's all right for me, but I'm not going to expose them to that.
We've just had a text message come in from Mona who says, good morning. What is the name of the book that you're talking about? Best Christmas gift for my boyfriend who is obsessed about hiking in K2. Unfortunately, it's not out yet, Mona, is it, Adrian?
No, it's only going to be launched on March the 10th, Saturday, March the 10th, last day Emirates Literary Festival at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. K2, The Tragedy and the Triumph.
So perhaps a very late Christmas gift. For Mona, yeah. For Mona's boyfriend.
But we could recommend one of the ones that you were talking about earlier, which is Living Dangerously by Sir Ranulph Fiennes.
Yeah. Or my other Footsteps of Thestia, Journey Across the Arabian Desert, which was the most amazing, rewarding journey I've done. And by the book will be launched in the UK and the US in next autumn as well. So we got some...
So sorry we can't be more helpful, Mona, but thank you so much for texting in. And if you have any more gift ideas that you need, hopefully we can help you on later on in the show. Jonathan, do you have any final thoughts for us today? Any final questions that you want to ask Adrian?
I would like to ask what, if anything, links the three authors that you've chosen to talk to us about?
I think the books, the three books sort of link, I think I mentioned earlier, it links my work, it links with perhaps the K2 book as well. Mm. Mind, Body, Spirit. Yeah,
remind us of the titles again.
The Living Dangerously. Sorry, the mind one was Awaken the Giant Within, Tony Robbins. Tony Robbins, I can't say that without sounding like it. Living Dangerously, Ranulph Fiennes, and The Celestine Prophecies, James Redfield. Mm. So yeah, there's a Mind, Body, Spirit on that, which, as I said, it's what I'm trying to put in this book on K2. And, you know, part of my work and my life as well.
Thank you so much, Adrian. Can't wait to see you at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature next March the 10th.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.